Briefly, he had perhaps become to them only another voice in their deliberations, if a queer, more resonant one, speaking from aloft. But what contempt the little familiarity had produced vanished in the face of that growl. The great, glossy, lowered head, with the eyes half a foot across, and glittering yellow slitted like lamps, over a jawful of serrated teeth, with the smallest the size of a man's hand. It was too palpable a reminder that they were in the presence of a creature who could have, with a stroke, killed them all, and with very little effort to himself. To Lawrence, Temeraire could never seem viscerally a threat, but he had handled the dragon from hatchling to maturity, and remembered him a creature scarcely larger than a dog.
"Lawrence has oaths and duty to you, and he would let you hang him, although I do not understand why,"
Temeraire said after a moment, low and angrily.
"And I cannot make him come away with me against his will, because that would also be wrong. But I will not let him be parted from me again, and if you do hang him, then I will take my friends and go, but not back to China. I will go to Napoleon, and I will tell him he may have my territory if only he destroys you all, and I will give him any help he wants of me to do it. Now threaten me again, if you like."
Lawrence stood wretchedly, helplessly. He ought to have expected it. Lian had done as much for the death of her companion, Prince Yongxing, had gone and put herself freely into Bonaparte's hands, with nothing at the time but contempt for him and all the West, and even though a Napoleon, the master of Europe, might turn his eyes against her own nation some day. And what sense of loyalty Temeraire might have begun to acquire to Britain, whatever Lawrence might have been able to instill in him, had been undone thoroughly, first by the Admiralty's plan to infect and kill all the dragons of the West, reserving the cure for British use, and by their later imprisonment and the death sentence on Lawrence, which had been used as a bludgeon against him, and now used once too often. To think his execution would leave Temeraire not free to make his own way back to China, but a devoted enemy of Britain, was a fresh agony. Lawrence had no doubt that such a threat would only make the generals despise him and the dragon all the more, and see in it his own scheme for preserving his neck by blackmail. They might choose not to provoke Temeraire again, while Napoleon had men on British soil, but that, he hoped profoundly, was only a temporary state. And then? Lawrence did not discount, as Dalrymple did, Temeraire's achievement. Without experience, or training for the task, or anything but will, he had persuaded 60 lazy, well-fed dragons to go with him to war, and had won 2 victories already against the French army. That Lefebvre was not the best of the marshals, that he had no great number of dragons with him, that Temeraire had only engaged with small companies, meant very little, next to the greater success that he had managed to keep his force together and fed. But these men might short-sightedly think themselves happy to be rid of Temeraire and any dragons recalcitrant enough to follow him, and if they did not, they would only take this as still more cause to try some low scheme of murder against him.
"Temeraire," he said, low, trying into the silence which lingered. "Temeraire, you cannot say such things. You are a serving officer now. These are your superiors. You may not make threats or growl at their orders. You must withdraw the remarks."
"I did not growl at the orders,"
Temeraire said after a moment, still low and angrily, but drawing away his head a little, and all around the circle one might see chests rising with postponed breath.
"I did not growl at the orders, and will not, no matter how stupid they are. But as for hanging, if anyone should try to take you from me again, I shall growl at them, and worse, and it is no use telling me I ought not."
"As one might expect,"
Maclean began a little faintly, only to be interrupted by Wellesley.
"Damn you, Maclean! Stop baiting the damned bear to see it dance."
Wellesley seized the moment and addressed the others, still silent and shaken.
"This is all nonsense. I do not believe for a minute that Bonaparte has come up with a man less than all his army, whatever fantasy the scouts have brought you. We can get 40,000 men at Weedon with their guns and supply, and if we give Bonaparte one of his precious pitched battles without every last one of them, we are a pack of fools."
"Then what do you propose we do?"
Dalrymple snapped.
"Stand aside and wave him on to London?"
"London was lost 3 days ago," Wellesley said, "if not 2 weeks ago, when Nelson was sent to Copenhagen with 20 ships and Bonaparte saw his main chance. The sooner we swallow it, the better. Get the men on the road tonight at once. They have been lying about with nothing to do but get drunk and gamble and whore for a week. They can give up a little sleep."
Cries of protest began rising through the stifled moment, accusations of defeatism and surrender. Wellesley raised his voice and kept going.
"Waste munitions and men and beasts to hold a lost position? We all ought to be hanged for traitors if we do it. To Scotland! To Scotland and the mountains, damn you all! He can't hold the country and keep the channel open both. Let him have England for a month. Let him spend men and dragons trying to hold it and march for Lochlagan. We will have 100,000 men by Christmas and come down on him when we choose, not Bonaparte.
And let him melt London dry and wreck the country in the meantime," one man shouted.
"Send men on to London to warn the tradesmen and the bankers out of the city with whatever they can manage," Wellesley said. "Half of them have gone running to Edinburgh already, after the king. Let the rest of them go too."
"If they choose to," someone said, "instead of stay and shake Bonaparte's hand as he comes in."
"If they mean to stay, they'll stay," Jane said. "You won't make 'em less eager by letting Bonaparte beat you beforehand. Scotland is the first damned thing of sense anyone has said. We needed these 60 beasts, Maclean, but you cannot throw 60 dragons like round shot and hope they land somewhere useful. In a week I will have worked out a way to use them, and by Christmas I will know how to do it properly. For tomorrow we can't do more than cut them loose on his flank and let them do as they like every which way."
"But that sounds perfectly agreeable to me," Temeraire interrupted. "I do not see at all why we ought not be able to beat Napoleon tomorrow, even if he outnumbers us. It seems quite cowardly to run away from him."
Lawrence sinkingly heard this speech, which he was sure could have no salutary effect. If he did not much like the idea of retreat, he had yet heard no plan of battle offered which gave him any confidence that the British were prepared to meet Bonaparte, and he was not heartened to see that those officers advocating loudest for battle were by and large those in finer clothes and fatter than field rations could keep a man.
"Oh, you wretched bloodthirsty creature," Jane said, "as if it were not bad enough dealing with all the thrusting out of chests already, now you must needs do it too. We need more sense, not less."
"I am not thrusting out my chest at all,"
Temeraire protested, pulling himself in rather concave instead.
"And I am being very sensible, because if you did run away, it would not do any good, at least if you go by foot as you have been. He will just go after you. He can catch you up in a trice. They go 50 miles in a day."
"Nonsense," someone said.
"It is not nonsense," Temeraire said. "Lefebvre's company, 8,000 men, were all near Newbury by Thursday morning, and they only landed at Deal on Monday, so he can do it."
There was a moment of perfect silence on all sides. It was one thing to argue over retreat, another entirely to hear the enemy could not be escaped. After a moment, Jane said,
"Well, he can beat us by the numbers, but we have around 2 dozen heavyweights now, and he hasn't more than 10, aside from his fleurs. I will take it on to beat his speed if you will only let me—"
"Put redcoats on dragons, yes, yes, as you keep saying," she was interrupted by another colonel. "I should like to see it."
"You can come to our camp if you would," Temeraire offered. "We have been carrying along a lot of them, although," he added severely, "if you wanted us all to carry, you ought to have spent a little time making carrying harnesses, which I know Lawrence told you of, because it would be a good deal more convenient than rope, and we could manage more. But perhaps if they do not mind being bundled up into sacks made out of tents, or belly netting—"
"I should damn well say they will mind," one general said.
"Are they soldiers or aren't they?" Wellesley snapped. "Shoot the first insubordinate bastard to refuse, and the rest of them will go quiet enough."
But it was too far. He and Jane were both shouted down.
"Enough of this craven council," General Dalrymple said. "We stand and we fight. General Wellesley, you will take the right flank tomorrow and hold the line at the barracks. General Burrard, you will take the left and plan on pinching him when he has worn himself out enough, trying to fight uphill against the main body of our force."
Wellesley stiffened at the assignment, something of a slap to be set in the position where less manoeuvring should be required and less initiative. He made no outward protest, however, but his fingers on the hilt of his sword drummed.
"And as for you, Roland," Dalrymple added, "if the damned beasts will not fight the Fleur de Nuit—"
"I did not say that at all," Temeraire said, bristling. "We will fight anyone. I only said we cannot stop them if you send us out of camp to do it. The Fleur de Nuit can see at night, and we cannot. It stands to reason they can go right around us, above or below. We cannot stop them just by lining up somewhere in their road and hoping.
You can hear them, can't you?
Dalrymple demanded, exasperated enough by repeated interruption to address Temeraire directly for once.
A Fleur de Nuit sounds just like a yellow reaper to us flying, Temeraire said. They beat at the same pace.
Lawrence blinked. He had never noticed such a thing, nor considered it as a difficulty, and by the expressions of the other officers, neither had any of them. Even Jane looked surprised by the intelligence, and she was an aviator of 30 years' experience and more.
"And anyway," Temeraire added, "one cannot tell where a sound is coming from closely, not when one is aloft and moving, and there are a great many other dragons about, all beating in circles. If the Fleur de Nuit should go past us one at a time, we would likely never notice them at all. And then we would come back, and you would complain we had not done anything. If you want us to stop them, you may say so, and then let us work out how it is to be done."
Chapter 8 Temeraire could not call it a very satisfactory conversation, although he congratulated himself on putting an end to the threats against Lawrence. But the generals were not very clever at all, and whatever Lawrence might say about superior officers, it seemed to Temeraire that if they were his superiors, then they ought to give him better orders than he could work out for himself, not worse. And some of them had wanted to run away, only because they did not have as many people.
"But at least I have spoken to a fellow from the ministry and told him that we require voting and pay, and he did not refuse, which I think is encouraging," he told the others. "And they have been sensible enough to let us manage the Fleur de Nuit how we like. Only now we must work out how."
"If we fight them here, right at the camp,"
Hosaitia said thoughtfully, the tip of her tail flicking urgently back and forth,
"then they must come right to us, to do any good, and there will be enough light from the fires to see them at least a little, and we can fight them off straight away."
"They need not fight you at all, if you are above the camp," Lawrence said. "They need only dart in and drop their bombs and fly away again. They are sure to hit something of value, without needing to be particular about their targets."
"Perhaps we should make a ring about the camp," Temeraire said, "and then, if we heavyweights fly patterns back and forth across, then they cannot come in without our noticing them, and we can catch them and teach them a good lesson. They will not long keep at it."
"Yes," Admiral Roland said, "and tomorrow we will have not a one of you fit to fly, which Napoleon will have bought cheap at the price of sending out 10 dragons, who are no good in the day any road. No, we can't spend near so much of your strength. Tonight every last heavyweight of you must eat, and get at once to sleep. You have already been flying more than you ought the day before a battle."
Unfortunately, the good sense of this rather dull objection, which Temeraire would have liked to dismiss, was making itself felt in a palpable way. Requiescat was snoring noisily in his corner, even though he was supposed to be attending to their conference, and Temeraire could not deny that he himself felt his mind drifting to his dinner more than seemed fitting with a battle ahead. He sighed and acknowledged the justice of it.
"But the little dragons cannot fight so many big without any of us," he said, "and we will need them too, tomorrow. Otherwise Napoleon will send all of his little ones against us, and even though most of us have not any crew to be captured, they will still tangle us up."
Admiral Roland rubbed her cheek with her knuckles, and then she said,
"Well, we can't spare the strength to keep them from the camp, so we had better keep the camp from them."
It was a little while before they could begin to put the plan in motion. Admiral Roland had evidently some arguing to do first, but at least the fires began to be put out all across the camp, and the men to take down their tents, grumbling against the cold.
"This is boring,"
Iskierka said to him, dissatisfied, as they sat waiting. A large square of forest just beside the camp was being marked out for them by middleweights.
"It is not at all as good as fighting, and I do not want to sleep."
"Well, you must sleep, or else you cannot fight tomorrow,"
Temeraire said, although privately he felt rather much the same.
"Now hurry. We do not have a good deal of time. The sun is already going down, and they will be sure to realize something is wrong if it gets dark and they can see everything is ablaze."
"Yesterday you did not want me setting trees on fire at all," she said, still grumbling,
but leaping aloft she strafed across the marked square with her flame until the trees began to catch. The middleweights had pulled up a good, broad line of trees all around and clawed up the dirt to make a firebreak. It made a fine blaze, pleasantly warm.
Temeraire,
Lawrence said, gently touching his neck, and Temeraire jerked his head up. It had been very comfortable to doze.
I am awake. Is it our turn yet?
He leapt aloft and studied critically the still blazing trees. He could not just cry away at them, for if they fell athwart the firebreak, they would catch all the rest of the trees, so he went in a careful perimeter about them and roared inward into the square. The fire-weakened trees crashed and fell in the most satisfying way, sparks flying up in great glowing orange clouds like small fireworks.
"Well, I suppose it is a little easier to knock them down," he admitted to Lawrence, "after they have been burnt some. Not that I could not have managed it alone."
"You must also reserve your strength," Lawrence said. "Another pass, and that will have done it, I think. Some trees left standing will do no harm." "The signal, Mr. Allen?" Lawrence added.
And when Temeraire had given the field another circle, the middleweights came in, dropping their loads of wet dirt, scooped up easily from the riverbed of the Thames with wagon-carts as shovels, and heaped it onto the remaining flames. What was left would not have been much use as a real place to rest. The field a wet and smoky mess, covered with heaps of debris, and the cracked stumps of trees poking inconveniently out of the ground at odd intervals. No one could have comfortably stretched out in it without a great deal more work done to clear it out. But there were still a handful of fires crackling left, smaller, which the men dug rings around to keep from spreading, and after a little shovelling here and there a handful of tents were put up, and from aloft it looked well enough, especially with the stuffed redcoats, coats and breeches filled with straw, which Admiral Roland's men had arranged about some of the fires.
"I like those," Persaetia said, eyeing the figures and paced back a few steps to examine them critically. "One must be quite close to notice, and I dare say if one were moving quickly it would be quite impossible."
"I hope it will do for the Fleurs, any road," Admiral Roland said. "And now the lot of you to the herds and to sleep. Lawrence, do you want your officers?"
"I would not have them removed from other posts if they have been placed," Lawrence said. "But I defer to your judgment, Admiral."
Temeraire tipped his head and put his ear towards Lawrence, puzzled a little to hear better his tone, which seemed to him a little odd.
"Are you not happy?" Temeraire asked anxiously, while he waited for his dinner.
The herdsmen at the pen were conferring together about the rations which they could provide, with occasional anxious glances towards the 60 dragons patiently arranged outside the fence. Lawrence had been so very quiet since the conference.
"We are together again, and we will soon beat Napoleon. I am sure the generals cannot help but see when that is done that we have done everything correctly. I see now," he added, "why they were ready to be so wicked. They are so afraid of losing. And I cannot really blame them for being afraid, because they do not seem to be very clever. But they might at least be clever enough to see that they ought to let us manage things, if they are not very good at it themselves."
"I would not for the world diminish your spirits," Lawrence said after a moment. "I am very glad indeed to be with you again, and for the prospect of action. But I will counsel you against that degree of overconfidence which lends itself only to disappointment. That," he added, lower, nearly to himself, "was perhaps as much as anything the cause of the Prussian loss."
"Well, they were very slow," Temeraire said, "and it seems to me so are these fellows, but at least now it cannot matter any longer, since we are to fight here. We do not need to hurry anywhere. Why ever is it taking so long?"
He stretched his head out over the fence.
"What is the difficulty?"
They did not have enough. That was the difficulty. Less than 80 cows in the pen, and all the harnessed dragons to be fed also.
"Then you must make soup, and roast and crack the bones to make it tastier, and so we can eat them more easily. And you might put some grain in it, and some vegetables," Temeraire added, to the rather perplexed-looking herdsman. "Lawrence, where has Gong Su gone to?"
"I do not know," Lawrence said. "He was privately hired, not an official member of the crew, and my affairs have been in no kind of order. I have not been able to carry on any sort of correspondence, nor meet my obligations. I expect he must have sought other employment. I hope he was successful."
"I did not think all my crew would be taken away in this fashion," Temeraire said, feeling rather displeased, "or I would have brought everyone with us to France. Except then, I suppose, they would all have been called traitors too, and perhaps some of them would not have liked to go."
"No," Lawrence said. "But I thank you for the reminder. I must make arrangements while I can. I must make inquiries after Gong Su and make good my other debts."
"There will be a great deal of time after tomorrow," Temeraire pointed out.
Lawrence paused and then said, "Best to clear away such things before a battle, my dear." The soup the herdsmen at length managed was not very good, even though they were all hungry enough to eat it. The meat and vegetables in congealed lumps at the bottom, and not very pleasant either, but squashy and flavourless. Only Gentius was pleased. He ate twice his usual amount, and pronounced it excellent, really excellent, and he would have another serving if there were any left.
"Not much like proper food," Requiescat said unenthusiastically.
"Well, tomorrow when we have beaten, we will go and get our own herd, and perhaps by then Lawrence will have got hold of Gong Su again," Temeraire said, "and then he will make us a feast to celebrate, something very nice, perhaps, such as what they cook in the Imperial Palace."
"I will be happy enough with a proper cow, fresh," Requiescat said, and then sat up abruptly, throwing back his shoulders, as with a great thump Maximus came down in the clearing before them and rattled all the trees nearby.
"Hum!"
Maximus said, and drew himself up on his haunches too.
"You are here!" Temeraire cried joyfully. "Is Lily with you also? Are you well?"
"Writer's rain!"
Maximus said absently, without looking away from Requiescat. They were both prickling up their spines and staring at one another directly in the eyes.
"Where is Maximus?" Temeraire said, puzzled. "What are you doing?"
"Lawrence!"
a voice yelled faintly from outside the camp, and Lawrence looked up from where he was sitting and writing.
"Lawrence! Get that damned lump of mine out of that camp! You have another regal there!"
"Oh,"
said Temeraire, and roared loudly over their heads. Maximus and Requiescat both jerked violently and turned to look at him instead, blinking.
"There! Now do not start that again. We have a battle tomorrow," Temeraire said, "and you had better stop Berkeley from running so fast, or he will have an apoplexy," he added.
Maximus turned his head and said,
"You do not have to run! What is there to be running for?"
As Berkeley came nearly staggering into the clearing, and Lawrence went to give him his arm to the fallen tree which Temeraire had pulled down for him to sit on. Berkeley stared from Maximus to Requiescat and back, very suspiciously, while he gulped for breath.
"Pray do not worry, I will not let them fight," Temeraire said. "I would have thought you had more sense,"
he added to them severely.
"I was not going to fight,"
Maximus said, unconvincingly.
"Only I have never seen anyone big as me before, except when I was still growing."
"The girls are bigger,"
Requiescat said, with rather a reminiscent tone.
"But that is different."
"I do not see why," Temeraire said, "and it is not as though a grand chevalier were much smaller."
He did not think he was much smaller either, but that perhaps would be rather puffing himself off to say.
"Don't much like them either," Requiescat said.
Maximus nodded vigorously in agreement.
"And we are on short commons," he added. "I knew you must be back as soon as they brought us this mess for dinner."
He nudged Temeraire's shoulder with his head in a friendly way. Temeraire wobbled, but managed with some effort to keep his balance.
"Tomorrow there will be plenty. And anyway, even if there were not, I dare say you could fly in opposite directions and find something without having to quarrel over it," Temeraire said. "But where is Lily?"
"She is in Scotland,"
Maximus said.
"Catherine has had the eggs, so she cannot be flying to fight."
"I suppose I did not tell you before. A boy,"
Berkeley said to Lawrence gloomily.
"So no use to us. And 10 pounds, damn him. Nearly killed her." "The egg is very noisy,"
Maximus added.
"I hope they both do well now," Lawrence said. "She can write and say so, which means she's only half dead, I expect,"
Berkeley said, and heaved himself up to his feet.
"Have you finished your damned card call?"
he said to Maximus.
"If this fine scheme of Roland's is going to do any good, you cannot be hopping all over the camp now it is getting dark, and you may carry me this time instead of heaving yourself off without a word."
"I only wanted to come see Temeraire a moment,"
Maximus said, putting out one great curved claw for Berkeley to climb into.
"And now we have, so we may go."
"We shall see each other tomorrow in the fighting anyway,"
Temeraire said with satisfaction, and curled himself up to sleep with a sense of great contentment,
only to be jarred rudely awake an hour later by the queer, muffled booming of bombs falling and the popping voices of the pepper guns answering. He put his head up and looked. He could not see anything much but the occasional white blooms of powder flash from the ground where the artillerymen were firing, and the great yellow bursts of flame as the bombs struck and burst. When there was no firing going on, he could only make out the faintest shadows of the handful of lightweights circling, mostly mongrels with better night vision than most, Minnow and some other of the ferals who had been organized into shifts to give some semblance of resistance to enhance the ruse.
"You ought to go back to sleep," Lawrence said, rousing,
and Temeraire lowered his head to nose at him carefully. How good it was not to be alone, and to know Lawrence was with him, and safe. Only it would have been better still if they might have gone fighting together.
"I will in a moment," Temeraire said,
privately hoping that perhaps the Fleurs might realize the trick any moment now, and they should have to go and join in. But the French dragons were flying too high aloft, and the fires on the ground and the explosions of their own bombs dazzled their sensitive eyes too badly, particularly with the flash powder being shot in their faces whenever the fighting detachment could manage. Arcady and some of his ferals, with their small crews, were taking a part. He sighed and put his head down again, twitching as yet another of the bombs went off. Silence woke Lawrence a little while before dawn. The bombardment had stopped. He rolled off Temeraire's arm and went to wash his face, breaking the crust of ice in the bowl and scrubbing as best he could. There was no soap. Smoke still rose from the decoy field, but the sky above was empty and lightening quickly. The French would be on the move by now. An hour, perhaps, would see them. A bell was ringing, distantly, a frantic note in its voice, and others picking up the alarm coming nearer and nearer, sounding all over the camp. And Temeraire put his head up and said exultantly,
"It is time to fight!"
He put Lawrence aboard into an odd arrangement with only the few straps of harness which Fellows and Blythe had managed for him and Alan and Roland to latch on to. There would be no one more going up with them. He had considered whether to dismiss Roland back to whatever post she had abandoned, from concern that it might seem a reflection on Jane, a kind of endorsement she surely would not have chosen to make. But he did not know where she had been serving, and when he had inquired, Roland had put out her chin and only said, "I should prefer to stay, sir," and she shook her head when he asked her if she had been signal ensign. "Fifth lookout, sir. I shan't be missed." Of course, Emily had no need to worry about her future, which was quite settled. She would inherit Exidium on her mother's retirement, a promotion guaranteed. Blythe and Fellows were ground crew masters and could always be sure of a place. Alan, however—
"No, sir. Well," Alan said, stumbling over his words, "that is, they hadn't given me a place again, sir, aloft. I was with the clerks, so it doesn't much matter for me."
It was, Lawrence privately and sadly felt, a better place for him. Alan was hopelessly clumsy, and more than once had nearly accomplished his own end, but Lawrence would not tell any man to stay behind the lines who wished to be in them. They now came stumbling from their small, cold shelter, little more than a few branches laid down on the earth next Temeraire's side to keep them from lying in the wet. Lawrence reached a hand down to help them up, where before many dozens would have been.
"I am coming too,"
another voice said, thickly accented. Lawrence looked over and saw Domaine standing already beside him, having come up the other side. The boy was bristling with arms, two small swords, two pistols, two knives, all with mismatched hilts, and a sack of small bombs slung over his shoulder, which he strung onto the harness without waiting for permission.
"No, you sit there,"
he told Alan, pointing farther back along Temeraire's shoulder to the lookout's place, and such was the air of decision that Alan meekly obeyed, though he had 3 years and a foot in height over the younger boy.
"Are you not assigned to Arcady?" Lawrence said.
"We are of your crew,"
the boy said, meaning himself and Sifo, whom Lawrence now spied down in the clearing, helping Fellows and Blythe to arrange their meagre supply of tools, waiting in case Temeraire should need to come back in for repairs.
"Both of us together, you said."
"That is quite right," Temeraire said, looking around, "and I am sure Arcady does not need him. He was allowed to fight last night,"
with a note of some disgruntlement,
"and will be sleeping late, and I dare say we will have won by the time he wakes up."
So they were four aboard, where 30 were common and hundreds had been managed, All of them latched to the one thick band. It circled Temeraire's neck and was joined by securing straps to bands about either of his shoulders, so it would not slide about. When they had all hooked on their carabiners, Temeraire sat up. And now Lawrence could see past the trees to where a cloud of French dragons was coming like bees, back and forth along the road, setting down great numbers of men and guns. He had seen these manoeuvres before at the Battle of Jena, and he was heartened a little to see that the British army was not waiting idly by, but guns were being hastily advanced to fire upon the French positions before they could be secured. The guns moved slow, however, men struggling to drag them forward through the mud, and already the French were answering nearly as vigorously.
"They are beginning without us," Temeraire said,
and his roar roused up all the dragons at once.
"The enemy are here. Are you all quite ready?"
he asked them.
"No, wait! I have an idea," the blue-green dragon said, the one called Pasitea, and leapt into the air.
In a moment she had returned, with something in her talons which she laid down upon the ground, a heap of the sodden and ragged figures stuffed with straw from their decoy clearing. Some were still smoking and charred.
"Tie them on to us,"
she said to the group of militiamen, rubbing their eyes, who had been sleeping beside her.
"Tie them on with rope."
"They are quite wet," Temeraire said, sniffing at the figures. "I do not see the use of that."
"They will think you are harnessed," Pasitea said. "Oh, and the paint. Where is that black paint? Bring it at once, too, and make straps on them."
"We have no time," Temeraire protested.
"Their dragons are not fighting yet," Pasitea said. "Very well, very well. We will do it only to the heavyweights. Do you not see?" she snapped. "They will jump over to try and board you, and then there will be nothing for them to latch on to, and you will have them off in a trice."
"Ha!" Jane said with satisfaction, when she had landed with Ixidium only a little while later, and had the plan explained to her, while the men finished painting Requiescat with the false harness stripes.
"Yes, very clever. They will smoke it soon enough, but while the trick lasts they will be jumping over to board you big ones by the dozens. All right, gentlemen,"
she looked over at Temeraire.
"Here are your orders, then. You unharnessed fellows will go in first, then, and go in close quarters at them. If you can draw their boarding parties, they will be undermanned when we come in, and we have the advantage in weight. He has only 8 heavyweight beasts brought up from the coast as yet. I dare say he has had to send the rest back for lack of food."
"And when you have come in?" Temeraire asked.
"Then I cut you loose against the flanks of their infantry," Jane said. "If we are all fighting aloft together, we will only get ourselves into a tangle. But you cannot do anything but good against them near to the ground, so long as you keep out of the line of fire of our artillery."
"And keep out of our acid, too," Ixidium added, and leapt into the air. "We have acid ourselves,"
the old long-wing Gentius muttered, from where he was perched aboard a big checkered nettle, Armatius. Temeraire turned his head and asked,
"Are you all quite secure?"
Lawrence checked his borrowed cutlass and pistols one last time.
"We are," he answered, and they were aloft, with a great surging rush of wind and many voices roaring as they rose.
Bonaparte's armée de l'air was seduced easily into trying again the strategy which had served them so well at Jena, the cloud of smaller dragons rushing the heavyweights loaded up with men. Lawrence looked away. 30 Frenchmen at once had flung themselves with enthusiasm and courage onto Requiescat's back to face the large company they expected, and a shrug of the great regal copper's shoulders threw them off into the air, grasping and futile, and a few of them cried out as they fell dreadfully until the noise ended below.
"Ow!"
Temeraire said, suddenly jerking, and Lawrence looked back to see that he too had been boarded, but one of the men, an ensign, had caught himself by stabbing a knife into the flesh and clinging to the hilt.
"Ow! Ow!"
Temeraire added as the French officer drew another blade and began crawling grimly upwards, stab by stab. Lawrence tightened his hands uselessly on the harness. If there was nothing for the man to cling to, there was also nothing for them to use, to climb back and fight him off, and the Frenchman was placed near the back haunches where Temeraire could not reach with his claws. And where, Lawrence realized, in a few more of his laborious steps, he would be placed to try and stab at Temeraire's spine.
"Take hold of the harness," Lawrence said to his small crew, and called forward. "Temeraire, we are well secured. Turn over and shake him free."
The world spun sickeningly, and for all his effort, Lawrence's hands pulled loose from the harness and left him dangling by the carabiner straps as they turned, once and twice spiralling, and righted again, all of them a little green from the close and rapid turn, and the two knife-hilts standing up alone from Temeraire's back, the small cuts trickling a little blood down his side.
"That has torn it, sir,"
Emily said, pointing, and Lawrence nodded. The French had noticed their lack of success and the loss of men. They were no longer trying to board, but turning a steady rifle fire upon the beasts instead. Quicker than he might have hoped, but their attempts had borne some fruit at least, and many of the French middleweights and lightweights who had so daringly come in close to the decoyed British heavyweights had paid for it dearly as well. Blood ran freely down many a side, black and steaming in the cold air.
"Throw out a signal, Mr. Allen. We are made," Lawrence said, and leaned forward. "Tamara, you had better pull away now and go for their flank. They have a weakness. They are on their right. Do you see it?"
"No," Temeraire said, rather reluctantly detaching himself from the pêcheur couronné he was presently mauling about, who had, with more valour than sense, made a run directly at him. But the movement of men below caught his interest after a glance.
"Wait, I do, where that ditch is in their way, and they are having to go around."
"Yes,"
Lawrence said. The French lines were compressed, awkwardly, where the men were crowding to advance, and they made an ideal target for an aerial strike which should drive a hole into Napoleon's flank not easily repaired.
"Quickly, before they have got past!"
"Alors, la prochaine fois vous feriez mieux d'y réfléchir à deux fois,"
Temeraire said to the smaller beast, before with a final lecturing shake he let it flee, and turning towards his fellows, gave a roar unlike any Lawrence had heard from him before. An odd, inflected sort of sound, rising and falling in almost an eerie, musical way. It pulled the attention of the other unharnessed beasts quickly, and they came peeling away from their individual battles with the French beasts as the formal ranks of the aerial corps charging forward took their place. As Temeraire banked away, Lawrence turned in his straps to watch. The ranks of the harnessed beasts of the corps were coming not in their usual arrowhead formations, but drawn out into a single, thin line of lightweights and courier beasts and middleweights. At intervals there was a small cluster, two middleweights in front with a heavy weight behind, like knots on a string. Maximus made one of them, red, gold, and roaring, behind Massoria and Immortalis. As the two forces met, the middleweights clawed their way into the cloud of French lightweights, opening room for the heavyweights to bull through behind them, the lighter British dragons engaging also but only a little, slashing and continuing on, so the whole line advanced together through the French ranks, scattering them above and below. It was as neat an answer as could be imagined to the harrying French strategy, and now the heavyweights were through and swooping with their tremendous loads of munitions, bombs and spikes dropping like a black iron rain down upon the French infantry and their gun emplacements. Lawrence could see Exidium, those vast purple and orange wings spread wide, as the long wing darted low with a protective guard of two heavyweights, and another who must have been mortiferous, with a yellower cast to his wingtips on his flank. Their acid caught morning sun and sparkled, descending, and a hot grey cloud of smoke and agony rose in its wake. The gap in the French defences did not last for long. The French dragons regrouped and flung all their heavy weights in a mass after the long wings, three petits chevaliers, a couple of défendeurs braves, a marbled orange-yellow chanson de guerre. Together they massed some 100 tons and more, and descending with ferocity they could not be turned aside. Exidium and Mortiferous were forced back up into the safety of the British line, the other British heavyweights turning to cover their escape, and the quick, skirmishing cloud of the French harried them back away from the field. Lawrence was only a very little aware of the last of this. Temeraire leading them down, they had stooped upon the infantry, shockingly low, and now the unharnessed dragons were wreaking a ruthless havoc on the awkwardly placed men, who could not easily get their guns up to shoot, compressed as their column was by the uneven ground. The great checkered nettle, Ballista, even landed herself fully on the ground a moment, and laid about her with her massive barbed tail in great sweeps. Temeraire was so close to the ground himself that Lawrence was able to draw his pistols and shoot four men from his back, and Domain and Emily accounted for another two apiece, Allen another. It was more difficult to miss than to hit at first, so packed were the French ranks, and then Lawrence and his small crew were all standing in their straps and drawing swords, as a few of the soldiers leapt aboard daringly.
"Hi! Look there! The eagle! The eagle!"
Monsey yelled in great excitement, darting around. But a young lieutenant shouted,
"À moi! Vive l'Empereur!"
and seizing the standard, leapt into the ditch itself, quickly followed by the remnant of the company. All of the men knelt, heedless of the wet, and together they became a bristling mass of bayonets and rifle fire, spitting at the dragons from below.
"Well, that is bad luck,"
Temeraire said, as they were forced to lift away for a respite. But Lawrence could not agree. They had wrecked the advance on the French right flank for too little cost to call it anything but good luck, the very best. Some of the dragons had taken fire, and a handful were turning tail for the camp, with shots to their wings or heads. And one smallish yellow reaper, being helped away by his fellows, had a long, dreadful bayonet slash across the belly, which had lain him open to the white gleam of ribs. But there were yet more than 40 in number, after casualties, and those who had been up at night fighting, and in a few hours the latter would return to the field. The opening gambits had been made. No decisive stroke yet had fallen. The aerial combat settled into the steadier, grinding work of attrition.
"You must send some of your fellows to rest,"
Lawrence said to Temeraire, when they had been aloft an hour, fighting nearly without a pause and in tiring style. The French had not made any more convenient mistakes, so it was all quick, darting strikes whenever an opening could be seized, to get past the pepper-guns and the rifles and do a little damage.
"You cannot get worn down. The French dragons will take advantage as soon as they see you slowing too far. You see, they are already going in shifts off the field."
"I suppose," Temeraire said, rather disconsolately.
"Only it is difficult enough already, with all of us, to manage to do any good, and we have not got a single eagle, or even taken a gun. There was that one Majestatis broke just now," he added, "but that is not as good."
"You are doing better than that. You have worn down their right flank, and the advantage to our own infantry will tell more and more over the course of the day,"
Lawrence said.
"You cannot expect a quick victory. Remember how long the battle lasted at Jena."
It was still more of a struggle to make him go and rest himself. He would not do so until Lawrence at last resorted to pointing out,
"If you do not, then you will get more tired still, and if Lien should come in at the last moment—"
"Oh," Temeraire said, "that would be just like her. I suppose I must. Ballista," he called, "you must take charge, so I can go and rest, in case Lien comes sneaking in later. I wonder where she is hiding,"
he added rather darkly, and craned his head up to spy the rear of the French lines hidden around a curve of the river. The sky was brilliant clear, and the sunlight, though not warming, was bright. Lien's red eyes and fragile white skin were vulnerable to such conditions, and likely, Lawrence suspected, she would make no appearance save in desperation. But if deception his suggestion were, it had sufficient good effect to make its own excuse. Temeraire grew rather drooping as they flew back to the clearings, and he fell with ravenous hunger on the dead horse which was laid out waiting for him, still in its cavalry saddle. He shut his eyes and was asleep at once after. Lawrence climbed down to stretch his legs and to let Fellows and Blythe make their survey of the abbreviated harness while he made his own, walking up and down Temeraire's sides to see what injuries had been made. The two knives Emily was now carefully removing, slowly, fresh blood trickling. The handful of stab wounds had crusted over, at least, but there were a good half-dozen musket-shot wounds, balls gone into the meat of Temeraire's flanks, and near one of them Lawrence was alarmed to notice a puckered mark he had not before seen. A recent one. A ball had gone in and not been removed.
"Sifo," Lawrence said, "go and find Mr. Keynes. You know him? Good. Find him, or Dorset, and bring them at once with their kit."
He dragged over a barrel and climbed up to lay his hand on the old wound. It felt a little hot and swollen, he thought, but perhaps it might only be the heat of battle, radiating from all Temeraire's muscles as he lay.
"Infection,"
Dorset pronounced with certainty, as soon as he had peered at it through his spectacles and touched it with his fingertips.
"My lancet, if you please, and have the tongs ready,"
he said to Sifo, and then he slashed deep through the pucker, past the layer of scales and fat. A gushing flow of white and yellow pus came running free, with a dreadful sour stench that made Lawrence turn his head away. Dorset did not pause even an instant, but seized the tongs and drove them in deep, and pulling away brought out the musket ball, black and shining with fluid, even as Temeraire roared awake with a bellow that shook the trees and knocked Dorset and Sifo and Lawrence all flat as he flinched.
"It is over already," Dorset said in answer to his shocked protesting, "and now you know why we take them out at once. It would have been more unpleasant if you were awake."
"I do not see much how," Temeraire said rather bitterly, "and at least I should have been warned."
"And should have jerked 20 feet away before I could have the ball out," Dorset returned, unrepentant. "Enough complaining. Now I must have the others."
"But I must go back to fighting,"
Temeraire said hurriedly, trying to escape. To no avail, and he put his head down, rough, flattened back, and muttered unhappily, as Dorset went prying after the other balls, which at least were less deep.
"It will be done soon," Lawrence said, stroking his head. And Domaine came out of the woods carrying a small deer, slung over his shoulders, which Temeraire picked and nibbled on for consolation.
Exidium came down beside them with a rustling like heavy silk, his great wings folding shut, and his crew swarmed down in a rush to treat his wounds. Only a few scattered claw marks and one musket ball, whose removal he bore with perfect stoicism. Temeraire's complaints, Dorset was now searing shut all the cleaned wounds, promptly fell silent.
"Here you are, then,"
Jane said, coming over and spying Emily, who looked a little hangdog as she was caught, red-handed, literally, for she was standing and holding the blood-wet instruments for Dorset as he worked.
"And has Sanderson given you leave from your post?" "Anyhow, Artemisia can only fly an hour at a time,"
Emily said. But there was rather a mulish gleam in her eye. Lawrence did not imagine she had liked her mother's former demotion, nor serving with the usurper.
"Admiral," Temeraire said, "have you any more orders for us? I am sure we could be of great use in fighting them aloft with you. And it is not much fun just poking the infantry," he added,
his brief, studied formality failing him.
"You all do very well where you are," Jane said. "It is no time to be going off half-cocked, old fellow. I will go so far as to say I think we are nicely placed. He is making us work for every inch, but we are getting them, and soon we will have them up against the trees. Closer run than I would like, but Dalrymple was right after all, and I was wrong. It was a good chance to take."
"I was sure it would go well," Temeraire said. "But I would like at least one more eagle before we make him run away again."
"If we take him," Jane said, and reached to scratch Temeraire's harness against such tempting of fate. "I hope we will get more than his eagles. We will get him." "Yes, he is here himself," she added, when Lawrence could not help himself but ask. "He is beyond the curve with his old guard and his pet Celestial, a splendid creature, what I have been able to see of her."
"I knew she should be hiding from the battle,"
Temeraire said darkly.
"Keeping them in reserve and her too," Jane said. "But that will not be enough. We have our own reserve. Iskierka will be waking up any moment now, and the others who are out tonight."
"She fought last night?" Lawrence said.
"Yes," Jane said. "One can't get her off the field once she is on it, not until the enemy has quitted. So I had Granby rouse her up when it began to get a little light and chase off the last of the Fleurs. Then she was tired enough to sleep a while. She will wake up full of vim and just what we need. Bonaparte has let Prussia go to his head, I suppose, and thought he could beat us with less than all his strength."
"I have just been thinking," Temeraire said after a moment, "where do you suppose his Grand Chevaliers are? And Marshal Davout, I have not seen his standards anywhere on the field."
"Returned to France, I imagine, or still on the coast, ferrying," Lawrence said. "And Davout?"
"Portugal, last report," Jane said.
"Well," Temeraire said, "there were two of them west of here. We stole their pigs, but they had plenty of food besides that. And Davout is not in Portugal at all. We saw him north of London 2 days ago."
"What?"
Jane said, and did not wait for an answer. She was running to Exidium at once, shouting orders and leaping for the harness and her speaking trumpet. Exidium going up, even while her ensigns latched her on.
"Alarm!"
Lawrence heard her shouting.
"Sound alarm! Enemy to the north!"
And flags were going out on every dragon as their crews caught the signal from Exidium's back. Temeraire sat up.
"Whatever is she so worried for?"
he said, looking at Lawrence rather indignantly. But Lawrence had a dreadful, sinking sensation.
"Aloft!" he said. "Come, we must go aloft as far as you can!"
and when Temeraire had climbed high enough to make trees and hills and farmhouses all blur into the wide, gentle curve of the earth, he paused, hovering, and in subdued voice said,
"Yes, I see them."
Davu was coming, directly for their rear, with 30 dragons and 20,000 men. Chapter 9. In another hour there would have been nothing to do but stand and be pounded to pieces from either side. The little early warning was enough to try and disengage at least, and Dalrymple at once issued the order for the retreat. Wellesley fought a brilliant rearguard action, bloody and terrible, stretching his men to hold the full breadth of Napoleon's line, while the rest of them withdrew behind that shield. But still the retreat became rout by the end. 10,000 men left floundering in the marsh to be taken prisoner, and the rest straggling ignominiously away north through the countryside, without more than their muskets and their boots, and sometimes lacking those. The dragons were carrying the guns, dispiritedly, and occasionally Temeraire would look back over his shoulder at the battlefield they had fled and the dragons in the distance chasing with a quivering ruff. He did not propose to turn, but looked away again and put his head down, dogged, and kept flying. Bonaparte's harrying pursuit fell off at last near evening. The French dragons, having laboured all day in battle or in carrying Davout's men near, had reached their limits and one by one began to sink further behind into the gloaming, until they must have been called off and could be seen turning away. Lawrence put his hand on Temeraire's neck.
"We have slipped the trap," he said quietly. "You have bought us that, at least."
"I still think we ought to go back,"
Iskiaka said, grumbling, flying beside them. She had been very angry to awaken, only to be told she would not have any fighting after all, and Temeraire only had managed to half-persuade, half-bully her into flying along with the rest.
"I am hungry, and I do not like carrying this cannon. It makes my shoulders ache."
"We are all hungry," Temeraire said in a temper, "so pray stop complaining. You are very tiresome."
"I am not," she said, "only because you do not want to fight and would rather run away."
"That is enough,"
Exidium said to her sternly, descending.
"We will go back when we are ready to and have more men and guns and can be sure to win. That is strategy," he added, "and you are old enough to understand it."
Iskiaka subsided, still muttering, as the older dragon flew on ahead. Somewhere far behind, the remnants of the infantry and cavalry marched on, towards reinforcements and resupply, at the well-defended central depot in Weedon Beck. The dragons, however, flew straight on through the night and the next day, putting an impractical distance between them and pursuit, and ensuring the safety of the artillery. There was not much for them to eat. The farmers hid their cattle, and they could not easily stop to hunt during the day.
"The quality must put up with having their game eaten," Jane said, and divided them up into small companies, each to make camp on an estate large enough to have a deer park. They would be in Nottinghamshire before nightfall, and Woolerton Hall had a herd of 400 or more. "I can send you elsewhere," Jane said, but Lawrence shook his head. He little wished to be at home in the present circumstances. A condemned traitor with the worst sort of news bringing 20 hungry dragons to tear up the estate. But it could not be helped. Worse if he took himself to some other house nearby without paying his formal respects, and let some other group of dragons use the grounds. That would be cowardice and shirking. If Lord Allendale chose to forbid him the house when he came, that was his father's privilege. His own duty was to endure the rebuke he had earned. They landed at last a few hours later, the dragons setting down their burdens with deep and grateful sighs. It was no joke even for a heavyweight to carry 2 16-pounders over a distance of 30 miles, and Maximus and Requiescat had been loaded down with 4 apiece. Temeraire sighed and stretched himself out upon the cool ground like a long black snake. Lawrence slid down from Temeraire's back, weary and sore himself with the long hours sitting dragon-back. "Will you speak to them up at the house?" Jane asked him, "or will I send Fret?"
"No, I will go," Lawrence said, and touching his hat, turned away.
"Pray give my best regards to your mother," Temeraire said, rousing a little when Lawrence rubbed his muzzle in farewell.
He walked slowly and with reluctance to the house, the windows mostly dark, and only a few link lights burning near the door. There were a couple of footmen outside gripping muskets nervously.
"It's all right, Jones," Lawrence said when he came close enough to recognize their faces. "It is only me. Is Lord Allendale at home?"
"Oh, yes, sir, but," Jones said, looking at him wide-eyed, and then the door opened. For a moment Lawrence thought it was his father, but it was his eldest brother, George, in slippers and dressing-gown over his nightshirt, and a valet getting a coat on over his shoulders.
"For heaven's sake, Will," George said, coming down the stairs.
He was Lawrence's senior by 6 years, and nearly as much time had gone by since Lawrence had last seen him. He had grown stouter, but the tone of exasperation was unchanged.
"That will be all," he added abruptly to the footmen. "You may go back inside."
He said nothing more until the door had shut behind them, and then, turning back to Lawrence, hissed,
"What in God's name are you doing here, and coming to the front door? You might have had a little discretion, at least. Are you hungry? Do you need—"
He floundered, and Lawrence flushed in sudden understanding and bit out,
"I have not fled jail and come to the door to beg. I am paroled to fight the invasion."
"Paroled?" George said.
"Paroled for the invasion? And here you are in the middle of Nottinghamshire. Who is likely to believe such a story, I ask you?" "Good God, I am not lying to you," Lawrence said impatiently. "I am not going to explain this twice over. Will my father see me?"
"No, I shan't so much as tell him you are here," George said. "He is sick, Will. 3 stone down since August, and the doctors have said he must keep quiet, do you understand, perfectly quiet, if we want him to see another year. He cannot even oversee the estate manager any more. Why do you think I am here? And no wonder, with the worry he has had. If you need money or some place to sleep—"
"I am not here for myself," Lawrence broke in on him at last,
feeling stiff and strange. The idea of his father ill, reduced, seemed unreal.
"I am here with the corps. We must requisition the deer to feed the dragons. There are 9 at present," he added, "and will be more before morning. I did not want you to be alarmed."
9? George looked towards the deer park and saw the lights, the shadows of many dragons moving.
"Then you are not lying," he said slowly. "What has happened?"
The news could hardly be concealed.
"Francis, outside London," Lawrence said. "The army is strung out from Weedon to here, and he took 10,000 prisoner. We are falling back on Scotland."
"My God," George said, and they stood together in silence a moment.
"Are you staying by the wood?"
When Lawrence had nodded, George said,
"Well, you may take whatever you need of the deer, of course. It is the king's right. There are the stables and the farmhouse. I will send food down to you all from the kitchens, and your commander, we can give him a bed."
It was all a long string of delaying tactics, and at last he came to it and finished awkwardly,
"I am still not going to have you in, Will. I am sorry."
"No," Lawrence said. "No, of course." He might have insisted for himself or his fellows. It was their right as officers to be quartered when there was room in the house, but he could not bear to do so. Jane might, if she chose. He could not himself force his way in.
"Will you tell me, will he come through here?" George asked him, low. "Ought I send Elizabeth and mother and the children away to Northumbria, perhaps?" "I imagine he will send men to take cattle for his beasts," Lawrence said. "But if he marches, he will march up the coast. He cannot leave our outposts behind his flank."
He drew his hand across his forehead tiredly.
"I am sorry. I cannot be sure of the counsel I am giving you, but I think there is no place much safer than here, unless you send them to Liverpool and by ship to Halifax."
George nodded again and turned and went up the stairs. He hesitated at the door as if he would have spoken again, but in the end he said nothing. He went back inside, and the door shut behind him. Lawrence walked back alone from the house, his feet sure on the familiar lanes despite the dark. No insect sounds or any noise but the sighing of wind occasionally, shaking the few dried leaves like rattles, drifting the smell of the dragons near, and of smoke. The ground crews of the harnessed dragons were making a little camp, not comfortless. Fire at least was easy enough to come by when Granby only needed to ask Iskierka for a little. The other captains were standing by it, warming their hands and talking in low voices, tracing the course they should take in the morning.
Some of the dragons were still arriving, who had guarded the rear of the retreat, and others already deep into their dinners, the lean bodies of deer stretched out limp upon the ground. Iskierke was doing the hunting, to the satisfaction of all except the smaller creatures of the forest, who fled out into the open with a panicked deer when she belched a roaring tongue of flame over the timber, mice and rabbits and sparrows, and a few poachers from the village fleeing with their snares. "We will head onwards to Scotland, to Lochlagan," Jane was saying, "and there wait for the army to regroup. It will be a precious slow trip for them, but Wellington will pick up 20,000 men at Weedon Beck guns, and another 20 in Manchester.
But can we keep the beasts fed along the way and while we wait?"
another woman's voice asked from above, as another long wing settled.
"Mort, be a love and set me down."
Lawrence had never met Captain Saint Germain before. She had long been assigned to Gibraltar. Mortiferous put her down beside the fire, a woman very tall and fat, with delicate features, a mop of fair hair curling in wisps, and pale lashed blue eyes, in complete effect rather like a Rubens painting. She could have made two of Jane, who was not slender, and likely would have tipped the scales over Berkeley. "The countrymen will find venison thin on the ground for a few winters, but we will manage somehow," Jane said. She looked around at a small shriek. The servants from the house with their lanterns and the baskets of food had come down the lane, and one of the maids had stopped and fainted on seeing the dragons.
"Why, I call that handsome, Lawrence. I hope you have given them our thanks," she said,
and waved her men forward to go take the food off their hands. Lawrence felt rather he might blush for the lack of hospitality that left them out in the cold, with the great house standing there on the hill, so many windows staring out empty with no one behind them. But he was evidently the only one so conscious. The other aviators walked up the hill with expressions of pleased surprise to meet the baskets coming, full of cold meat and bread, fresh boiled eggs, and many pots of hot tea. One servant did come down the hill with them, carrying an enormous steaming platter that smelled pungently of Oriental spices, and even before he had stepped into the firelight and Lawrence saw his face, Temeraire had already raised his head and said joyfully,
"Gong Su, you are here!"
The cook came forward and bowed repeatedly, to Temeraire and then, as afterthought, to Lawrence, beaming as he set the platter down to be attacked by the aviators.
"I am glad to find you well. But how came you here?"
Lawrence asked.
"Lady Allendale's generosity,"
Gong Su said, and turned to Temeraire, explaining in Chinese that Lady Allendale had written the corps and obtained the names of all Lawrence's followers, to see them taken care of by one means or another. She had given Gong Su a place.
"And he says that he will come with us again,"
Temeraire added with satisfaction, to the end of this translation.
"So we may have properly cooked food, and if we will stop eating the deer now, he will soon have them stewed for us with some grain."
At this announcement, several of the dragons unenthusiastically drew their deer all the closer, and began to eat as quickly as they could. A fuss was still being made along the path, the maid now enjoying her hysterics sufficiently to resist being helped away by a couple of the footmen, who would just as lief have been gone themselves.
"That is quite enough, Martha. Pale, take her back to the house and give her hartshorn,"
Lady Allendale said, putting an end to the noise. She continued on towards them steadily, well wrapped in furs, and trailed unhappily by a footman with a lantern, who lagged as they came closer and closer the clearing. Lady Allendale herself paused near the edge. She had last seen Temeraire some 10 weeks after his hatching, before he had reached his full growth or even sprouted his ruff. It had been rather a different experience to encounter one half-grown beast in broad daylight than now a dozen of them, mostly heavyweights, and the alarming orange-eyed longwings, all of them up to their jowls in blood and magnified by the flickering of the fire upon their scaled hides. Lawrence was already on his feet. The other officers hastily stood as she came in timidly to their circle.
"I am very happy to see you again, my lady,"
Temeraire said, adding in an undertone to Lawrence,
"That is correct, is it not? And thank you for keeping Gong Su safe for me."
"Quite correct,"
Lady Allendale said, and coming forward with a struggling, unhappy smile, gave Lawrence her hands. He silently bent and kissed her offered cheek. It was paler than it had been, the skin a little dry and papery and more lined. Her hair was quite silver.
She did not keep smiling long, but let it fade, and took his arm for a support she for once truly needed to look round the camp.
"I hope you are all comfortable. We shall be happy to make up beds inside for you, gentlemen. I am sure room can be found."
No one immediately answered her, and then Jane had to say, "We do very well here, ma'am, although I thank you for the hospitality. We sleep with our dragons when we are on the march. Fred, can you manage a chair?" she added, and Lady Allendale looked at her and at Lawrence with a bewildered expression. There was no help for it, of course, and he said,
"Mother, may I present Admiral Roland of Exidium? Lady Allendale."
Jane bowed and offered a hand to shake. Lady Allendale had recovered herself enough to accept it with cordiality, and also the folding camp chair which Fret brought from out of Jane's tent and set near the fire, with another for Jane herself. Captain Saint-Germain was walking up and down the camp, stretching her legs, and had not noticed the visitor yet.
"Thank you, Fret. I had rather stand. We will be sitting all day tomorrow," she said when he offered her one,
and then pulled up short, seeing Lady Allendale. There was a little awkward silence. Lady Allendale gazed with fascination at Jane and at Saint-Germain and around all the camp, with more attention than she had paid before to the other aviators. She was no fool. Lawrence saw her marking out, quickly, the handful of other female officers, another on Jane's crew, a lieutenant on Berkeley's, and a few midshipmen and ensigns scattered about. No one offered any explanation, and of course she did not ask, but only said to Jane,
"You are bound for Scotland, then?" politely.
"Aye, ma'am," Jane said. "I hope we do not put you out." An admirable beginning to a brief exchange of wine and small conversation which might be quickly brought to a close with no rudeness on either side. But Temeraire was now unoccupied, waiting for his dinner to be cooked, and he put in anxiously,
"Perhaps you had better come with us and not stay here. I have just thought of it. Perhaps Napoleon may come here before we have had a chance to beat him properly."
"You cannot be carrying about civilians where you like," Jane said to him repressively. "A nice job we would do of keeping anyone safe when it is our duty to go look him out. He may come marching through here by bad luck or not, but we are sure to meet him sooner or later."
"Yes, but when we meet him we can fight him," Temeraire said, "and be sure of keeping our friends safe."
"I am very grateful for your concern," Lady Allendale said gently. "But we will not go, I think. It would be quite unforgivable to leave our servants and the tenants alone to manage in such circumstances. That is our duty."
But this quite changed the conversation. She then inquired of Jane whether her own family was somewhere safe.
"I haven't any to worry for, but my Emily, and of course I'm lucky enough to have her in eyeshot at present," Jane said,
nodding at where Emily was helping to put up the camp. And naturally then Emily had come over to be introduced, and having made her bow, added earnestly,
"And thank you very much, my lady, for the present. I'm much obliged to you."
Lawrence knew his mother well enough to see, as most strangers would not have, that she was puzzled. And then understanding dawned.
"Do you like the Garnets, then?" she said,
and leaned forward to look searchingly into Emily's face with a very different sort of interest, while Lawrence felt his heart sink. In London, the past year, his father had drawn entirely the wrong conclusion from Emily's presence among Temeraire's crew and Lawrence's evident responsibilities towards her, and he had passed that conclusion along to Lady Allendale in terms not sufficiently guarded as to prevent her becoming very interested in Emily's welfare.
"Oh, yes," Emily said, "and I have been able to wear them twice to the theatre in Dover." Are you in service, then?"
Lady Allendale asked, willing to be inquisitor of a young girl, and where she felt she had a right, as she had not been of Jane herself. Emily unconcernedly nodded, unaware of any undercurrent, and said proudly,
"I am lately made ensign, my lady." "There, enough puffery. Dorset is looking for you,"
Jane said, more discreet, and Emily bobbed once more and dashed away. Lady Allendale watched her run back to her duties. The surgeon was working over the dragons. Temeraire was not the only one of the unharnessed beasts who had been carrying a musket ball too long, and several of them were having to be treated in similar wise. Fortunately, he was downwind at present, and working on Ballista's far side, so the gruesome operation was not in open view. Emily vanished around her flank, and Lady Allendale turned back and ventured,
"She is very young," to Jane,
with not a little anxiety.
"Oh, she has been in harness since before she could walk," Jane said. "We start 'em young, ma'am, so they don't have much to be trained out of. And then she must be up to snuff to take Exidium when I get too long in the tooth to be scrambling about aloft." "Well, I see where you come by it," Jane said to Lawrence later. "Most of the dragons and the aviators asleep, and the fire crackling to cover their low conversation, a conversation made easier by several glasses of the wine which had been sent down for their supper. All that noblesse oblige. But it is not stiffness. I like her. That is prodigious kind of her to have taken an interest in Emily. Does she think her your by-blow?" So Lawrence, who had been hoping devoutly Jane had noticed nothing out of the ordinary, had to admit the wretched muddle. Jane laughed heartily, as he had feared she would, but under the circumstances he found he could not be sorry to have given her a cause for unfeigned pleasure, even one embarrassing to himself. "Why ever did you not set her right?" she said, amused. "No, never mind. I expect she has not said a word about it openly, which you could answer, and you would not broach the subject if hot pokers were put to you. It must be very inconvenient, talking of anything awkward in your family." She fell silent then. It evoked too well their own awkward circumstances, and she looked down at her cup and rolled it between her palms.
"I do beg your pardon," Lawrence said after a moment. "With all my heart."
"Yes," Jane said, "but you beg it for the wrong things, charging off alone without a word, and that appalling letter you left for me, all 'I could not love thee, dear, so much,' as though you owed me apology as a lover and not as your commander. I blushed to show it to anyone, and of course it had to be handed over. For a week I could cheerfully have run you through myself, sitting in rooms with them reading out bits of it in insinuating tones, and putting Sanderson over me, damn them."
"Jane,"
he said, "Jane, you must see, I could ask no one. To have put you in such a position—" "What position which you did not put me into regardless?" Jane said. "They could not have suspected me more if I had really had all the guilty knowledge in the world."
"If I had spoken, you should have been obliged to stop me," Lawrence said.
"And a good thing, too, if I had," Jane said. "One private note to some Frenchman with a little rank, and they would have had the mushroom in hand in a month. Do you think every servant at Lochlagan is incorruptible, knowing that Bonaparte would pay 1,000,000 francs for the damned things?" He recoiled inwardly, and she saw it. "No, of course it would not have suited you to have done the whole thing quietly, you and your damned honour."
"It would not have been any less treason," Lawrence said.
"No, but as you were bent on that, in any case, it would have been a good deal less pain," Jane said, and then she rubbed the back of her hand across her forehead. "No, never mind, I do not mean it. I do not suppose there was any decent way to go about it. All decency was already gone. But damn you anyway, Lawrence." He felt the justice of her rebuke and bowed his head over his hands. After a moment she added, "And to crown the whole, you must needs come back and make a martyr of yourself, so now anyone who cares a farthing for your life must watch you hanged. That is, if they do not decide to make a spectacle of it and draw and quarter you in the fine old style. I suppose you would go to it like Harrison, as cheerful as any man could do in that condition. Well, I should not be damned cheerful, and neither should anyone else who loved you. And some of them can knock down half of London town if they should choose."
"I should certainly choose," Temeraire said, and thought to himself that he would make a point of speaking again to the ministry gentleman, or perhaps one of those generals, to make it perfectly plain. "Pray do not worry, Lawrence," he added. "I am sure they will not be so foolish."
"Men can be very foolish indeed," Lawrence said. "And I must, I do beg you not to enter into a resolution which should prevent my being able to face death with equanimity. You should make me a coward if I must fear that my death should turn you against my country."
"But I do not at all want you to face death with equanimity," Temeraire said, "if by that you mean letting them hang you instead of making a fuss. If that should make you unhappy, so should I be unhappy if you were killed. It was dreadful, so dreadful, when I thought that you were gone. I did not feel as though I knew myself any more. I even wanted to kill poor Lloyd for no reason at all, and I do not ever wish to feel so again."
Lawrence said, "Temeraire, you must know that you shall inevitably. I have 20 years, or 3, perhaps at most, and you 10 to look forward to."
Temeraire flattened his ruff, unhappily, not wishing even to speak of the matter.
"But that, at least, will not be anyone's fault. No one will have taken you."
the distinction was very plain in his mind. Anyway, he did not mean to think about something so far away and misty. Perhaps he might think of some way to prevent it by then. If dragons might live 200 years, he did not see why people might not also. He turned his head gladly as Monsey came dropping down beside him.
"Timmeré, they are hungry over by Nottingham Castle. There were not enough deer for everyone."
"They may come here and share our breakfast," Timmeré said, indicating the great pit where Gong Su had made them a great thickened wheat porridge flavoured with venison and greens and preserved lemons. It had been ingeniously made waterproof by a thick lining of canvas, and heated by stones which Iskierka had fired dropped in. "And from now on we will all go shares. You must all admit," he said to the others, "it is perfectly nice."
"Nothing as good as a fresh hot buck all to oneself," Requiescat said, grumbling.
"Well," Temeraire said, "if you prefer, you may take a single buck or a cow to yourself instead of 3 days of soup or porridge, because that is how far they may be stretched, Gong Su says."
He was very happy to turn to such mundane affairs, and to pretend that he and Lawrence had finished their conversation, and were again in perfect accord, although it made him feel a little ashamed. He knew Lawrence would not interrupt anything which was like work. Lawrence did not think much of officers who had conversations or pleased themselves while their duty waited, so it was a good excuse, and as long as Temeraire made himself busy, he could be sure not to be asked to return again to the difficult and unhappy subject. He was quite resolved that he was not going to let Lawrence be killed, no matter what. Lawrence would certainly never be happy after being killed, so it did not seem to Temeraire much consolation that he should be a little happier beforehand. And Temeraire was now very sure that the only way to be certain of protecting Lawrence would be to make it plain to their lordships that something dreadful would happen to them if they dared to hurt him. So he had no intentions of withdrawing his threat. But he could not help but peer cautiously sidelong to where Lawrence was speaking now with Admiral Roland. He looked tired, and although, of course, he would not let his shoulders slump, there was some quality of unhappiness in the way he stood, and Temeraire's conscience smote him even while he considered his escape from the discussion with gratitude.